Each person has a role to play. If you're an intern that just started your job last week, okay, maybe you're not going to call out the SVP at the meeting when he said something super sexist, but it's like you're connecting with other women in your organization and you've joined Women in Revenue and you've joined a ton of other different organizations where you can get support and start to understand how you can get your power and like where are you going to, what are your values and where are you going to define, where are you going to take a stand? You can't take a stand for everything. You might be completely exhausted if you do that. So I think it's about finding where your values are individually, where you have your power and where you have comfort and where you think you can make the most difference.
Hi there. Welcome to On the Flip Side, a podcast for anyone who wants to live their best sales life. We're going to be talking to buyers, sales managers, SDRs, and AEs about things like, what does it take to be a great sales manager? Or how can you go home happy month after month? So let's dive right in. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of On the Flip Side with Wingman. I'm Kushal. I'm really excited to introduce our guest today. She's been the driving force behind many successful launches when it comes to sales and marketing. She's also been a key member of the RevGenius community and has been involved with scaling their member onboarding program. She's also super involved with diversity and inclusion efforts across the board. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I remember doing the beta test of Wingman, and it's completely flourishing, and I'm so thrilled to see how it's performing, and not just on LinkedIn, but obviously as a business and helping many salespeople.
Great. Thanks so much, Catherine. So I guess let's jump right into it. You're obviously a member of the Women in Revenue group of leaders, and you're also passionate about education and awareness of diversity and inclusion in the workplace. So my first question is really, despite all of this awareness around DEI efforts, where do you think companies fall short and why?
I hope that in the last 18 months, more research, more data, the work from home, obviously COVID, where you know terrible things happen. But the sliver of a silver lining to me is that we were able to embrace whole people and not just their small part of what they do at work. And to me, that means that we are appreciating the relationship building and the collaboration and all the other skills. I don't want to gender stereotype. I always like have a fine, it's a fine line between perpetuating stereotypes and embracing innate qualities that maybe women bring to the workforce and particularly to sales. And I feel that there's a lot more data, there's been a lot more focus, and there's been a lot more research. And I don't feel like discouraged about it. I feel that, yes, maybe we all agree, everyone agrees, diversity means more money, it's great for the world. And I feel like now we're having the frameworks and the mechanisms by which to actually make that happen. So I feel like focusing on the actual tools and the data and how to use that data to like really dig deep into an organization's structure and provide more training for leaders, I'm optimistic that we can make actual inroads on this massive and unnecessary gap in the near future and an ongoing process.
Catherine, I think it's really interesting about how you talked about perpetuating stereotypes when it comes to gender, right? I think that's actually an interesting line. Like, how do you kind of do that balance between, you know, A, kind of shining a light on how things are, and then B, saying, you know, what they need to be better.
I was thinking about this a lot recently because I've been very involved and I'm very passionate about female founders. And as we know, I could rattle off the stats, but you can Google them. What percent of money go to female founders? What percent of companies are actually female-led versus the revenue and the funding they get? And there's a big debate in the female founder community that I just want to be a founder. I don't want this other label on me. I don't want to be a female founder. And for me, I grapple with the idea that until we are at equity, until we are at parity, until we don't need these labels, I think it helps to initially shine a light on something, to notice the gap, to understand the gap, to research the gap, to really dig into the tools we can use to overcome the gap, and then have a future where it's just salespeople and it's just founders and it's just CEOs and doesn't have to be 50. You know, I loved the 50 over 50 on Forbes that they just did, which is great. And then we don't have to be like, oh, only two women made the top five, you know, Fortune 500 CEOs. Like, we don't need to label it like that, but I don't think obviously we're there yet. So I think I tried to look at the immediate impact that putting a few labels on and not trying to perpetuate stereotypes, it can really showcase and highlight this gap and make more people aware of it and then find the ways to overcome it. But it's definitely a balance, and I struggle with like each time it comes up, where do I stand on it?
I think it's interesting how you've talked about, you know, a lot of founders don't want to be labeled as women founders. And it's interesting because I have, you know, I've had the exact same discussion with Shruti, our CEO at Wingman as well, about how she doesn't particularly enjoy kind of the label of, you know, what it means to be a female founder, because her retort is always, what does it mean to be a, what does it mean to be a male founder?
No one.
So I think that's super important to kind of, but I think the balance there again comes from knowing that not everyone has the same experience. And like you said, for some people, their gender or any, you know, any part of their identity doesn't hold them back, but that's not true for everyone. So until we reach that point of maybe things being more equitable across the board, maybe some of these stories still need to be told.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that does, you know, gender is just a small piece of it. Obviously, the racial, the sexual orientation, the able-bodied. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of other isms that we need to overcome. And I also recognize that the, you know, feminism has been entrenched in, you know, racial divides as well. So how do we collectively look at each piece of this, but recognize that their unique experience as a white woman, as a woman of color, as a gay woman of color, and how do we all work together for the greater good and appreciate the nuances that each person has to bring and overcome and their challenge.
So Catherine, when you're talking to companies about kind of, you know, upping their diversity and, you know, creating a workplace that is inclusive, what are really the top five things or the top pointers that you give them on how to get started on this?
There are people are way better experts on this than me. I'm just very passionate about it. And I certainly include it in all the work I've been doing. I mean, it's across the spectrum. It's not just like, okay, now we're going to target the historically Black colleges and get a few more people in the pipeline. It's the whole spectrum. It kind of like the customer journey. It's the employee journey, right? It's the employee engagement journey. So it's the true diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. So it's looking at all the facets of your organization. And not just the mission statement that you put in the annual report, it's looking at the organizational level, the business unit level, and then the manager level. I went to an excellent masterclass a couple of weeks ago with a woman from the Golden State Warriors, which obviously is very topical given the NBA playoffs and things. And she had a great way that the Warriors do it that is for basketball, but I think it can work for a lot of companies. They talk about feet, tongue, heart, and I can't remember the other one, but it was that how they talk about things in the community and how they talk about their diversity and inclusion and how they act in the community and how they target unknown and undiscovered places that they can recruit talent. And it is their values, the heart of it, like what are their policies? Are they training their managers? How are their managers navigating conversations or situations they haven't had before? And are they having employee resource groups? And then they're also looking at their vendors and suppliers and their sponsors. Like their sponsors are a big part of their cash flow and their revenue. But they really, really care that their sponsors are aligned and their vendors are aligned and their suppliers are aligned with their values and what they're trying to do. So they have a very multifaceted framework. And I think that's the key, like having a framework and not just being like, okay, we're going to do this one thing. It's like looking at each piece of your employee experience across, you know, all levels and across the whole journey as someone gets recruited or even before that, where they find out about you, how the experience is when you're getting recruited and you're going through the interview process, how you're onboarding, and then just looking at their continued learning and development. So it doesn't have to be as complex, I think, as some people make it. It just takes a lot of work and you have to be committed to it. I think that's the key. To me, I've had to summarize it from the top down and the bottom up. Like people need to be committed to it and make it happen.
I think that's a great point, Catherine. Yeah, clearly there's a lot of work to be kind of done in the back end. Okay. Here's another question for you. When it comes specifically to women in sales or really in business overall, do you think that we've actually achieved parity in, say, wages, equality, respect? Do you think something's still missing there? And what do we need to do
to bridge that gap? I feel like I don't want it to be a slow boat, you know, that we're, you know, eking out a 1% change a year. But I do try to appreciate my very first job, as was Shruti's, on Wall Street, where you're totally a young woman on Wall Street. I was on the trading floor with 700 plus men, maybe 50 of us were women. And I try to appreciate the people that have come before me that have got us to the place I was when I started. And now I hope to pay it back. And it's a continuous spectrum. But when I started, I've told the story before, but it really has stuck with me, obviously. In my training class, I was the only female in the, you know, sales and trading group. And then we were combined with the investment banking and we finished our training class. And it's supposed to be like, get pumped. You're starting a new career. We want you to be here at Merrill Lynch for a long time. You're like, you're the best of the best. And we had awards, kind of like high school awards that they have in American high schools. And it was the who's going to be most likely to be a managing director. and only the men were candidates. I was like, okay, yes, if you look at the data, there's like only 5% of us that are women that are starting. So out of the gate, if you're a bookie, you're going to put your odds on the men. And you look at over the time, they didn't have great maternity leave programs. They didn't have great mentoring programs, etc. So statistically, yes, the men, the bookie would put the money on the men. But it wasn't a bet. It was like an organization trying to make you feel welcome your first few weeks on the job. And so I was so outraged. So I went up to the head honcho. I'm like, you're presupposing that no women are ever going to be a managing director. This is kind of a spoof award. So what would it have mattered if you included a few females, even though there's only very few of us? Anyway, I clearly still get worked up thinking about that.
What happened at the end of that?
And so for the ongoing piece, I like to look at it. What can I do individually to bring situations forward? What can I do to help women, you know, at all stages? You know, I don't feel like a mentor relationship has to be an age-based thing. There are people that are much younger than me and I learn a ton from them. And likewise, I hope to, you know, help and support women of different ages and men too, to be allies. And so I look at what can I do individually? And even if it's like we're chipping like the smallest piece away, it's bringing attention to when something doesn't work. Like, so for instance, you mentioned some of the communities. If there are examples where men are saying, oh, well, only men will understand these sports analogies, or only men learn lessons from sports, and what are your business lessons from sports and things like that, I don't try to be strident about it, but I say, hey, we're supposed to be an inclusive community, and women are 50% in the US of like the high school sports athletes. We learned a lot of lessons from sports too. Oh, and by the way, I worked in professional sports and we also can be sports fans. It doesn't have to be gender-based. So I think in small instances like that, is that going to change the world? Obviously not. But I think in those situations, you speak up. Like other people might not have the capacity to speak up, but I'm at the stage where I'm definitely going to speak up and hopefully do it in a meaningful, you know, kind way that opens people's eyes as opposed to make them defensive in a collaborative, inclusive way. And there's the collective piece. So we're all like, we're doing the studies, we're thinking about how we can hold companies accountable. So there's the individual piece and then the collective piece where we're, you know, it's like we're coming at it in two ways. So I feel really strongly that each person has a role to play. If you're an intern that just started your job last week, okay, maybe you're not going to call out the SVP at the meeting when he said something super sexist, but it's like you're connecting with other women in your organization and you've joined Women in Revenue and you've joined a ton of other different organizations where you can get support and start to understand how you can get your power and like where are you going to, what are your values and where are you going to define, where are you going to take a stand? You can't take a stand for everything. You might be completely exhausted if you do that. So I think it's about finding where your values are individually, where you have your power and where you have comfort and where you think you can make the most difference. And then collectively make, you know, getting these women in revenue and types of groups like that. So we're all sharing resources, we're supporting each other, and we're hopefully then also chipping away at the bigger situation.
I really love that point about speaking up, right? And especially, I think that's especially important because for a lot of people who are still possibly younger, sometimes you don't have that confidence to go into a room, like you said, and kind of say, you know, call out, you know, any form of really bias or stereotypes. So I think it really is up to a lot of people who maybe do have that stronger voice to maybe kind of be bearers of that voice.
In the US, there's a lot of talk about bullying. I mean, I hope in the schools, the bullying is less. I'm sometimes not sure it is, but they have a term here called be an upstander, which I know is a universal term as well. But it's that a key piece that I didn't mention before is the male allies. So that you're not operating in a vacuum. You're bringing them into the fold and you're like showing, like just connecting with them on a personal one-on-one level. So they can appreciate whatever challenges you individually or collectively as women be going through. And they can be an advocate. They can be an ally and they don't have to be like waving the flag at the annual company parade, but they can at least again be seeking. It would be kind of fun. And so it's a situation where if in a setting, in a meeting, they're like, oh, Sally, why don't you take the minutes? If a male ally is there, they can be like, actually, John, why don't you take the minutes this time? So just little things like that. So you don't perpetuate, oh, the woman is going to take the minutes. Like there was something, it was a very inclusive community that was supposed to be happening. And there was a situation, was a meeting. And it very much was like, oh, you take the minutes. And I was like, we're supposed to be this inclusive community. I don't think we should just jump to like this person taking the minutes. We should figure out a better way to do this, not just make assumptions. And so the male allyship is that, you know, even in as adults, we still want to belong. We still want to feel like we're part of the cool crowd. And so if you're back and say, you know, everyone's back at work whatever, it's an annual meeting, whatever it is, where people are actually physically together again. And, you know, when John is over by the water cooler and he hears some guys, like the cool guys or whatever, talking smack or saying terrible things, like if he's empowered and feels connected to the plight and the advocacy of women, he can speak up and be like, hey, I don't think this is appropriate conversation. So it's not just, you could have the advocates being upstanders when you're not even there, but they also putting themselves on the line, right? Because they, maybe they want to go play golf with Bob and now they're going to not get the spot to go Bob. So they have to be, you know, feel a stake in it as well. So yeah, being an upstander is something that I've learned through my nieces who are 9 and 13. And it's a wonderful idea that you're not just sitting on the sidelines hoping you don't get bullied. Like you're actually putting yourself forward to redirect a conversation, to redirect a dialogue, to redirect points of view that people have and hope that you can make small little.
I think the idea of, you know, men, for instance, if it's a gender divide that you're kind of dealing with, kind of being equal allies right from the beginning is so important. For instance, you know, if you go back some 20 or more odd years, in some schools here, right, when you have sex education classes, yeah, as they would put them, you know, so during all of the sessions around reproductive health, girls would be separate and then boys would be separate. And for the life of me, I never understood that, right? Exactly. You can't have a discussion around gender equality without everyone being in the same room.
It doesn't work. I know, that's such a great point. My niece, I think that they have some classes combined now with boys and girls. And sure, they're in fifth grade and sixth grade and they're like, what's going on with my, you know, my body, myself, and they're feeling awkward and their hormones are starting to kick in. However, it's like the men, the boys are learning about the women and the women are learning about the boys, right? It's like right from the start where you start to recognize the, you know, physical differences and whatever the differences happen between boys and girls as they grow into men and women. But yeah, separating it right from the start is creating a divide of knowledge and appreciation. So,
well, I guess that sounds like community is really sort of the way to go when it comes to bridging a lot of these things, right? Which actually really perfectly puts us into the next segment of what I'd love to talk about with you, which is really about community-led growth. And you've obviously been one of the key people at Rev Genius and you've helped scale up their member onboarding program as well. And really, community-led growth is becoming
really
such a buzzword.
So nowadays, right?
What would you really want to tell people who probably come up to you and ask, oh, you know what, maybe I should kind of, maybe we should do this? What
I know the product thoughts? Communities have been around for a long time and I'm like less familiar with those. I don't want to represent that sector. And I was new to LinkedIn. So I basically, to take a step back, I was working, you know, partially, not full brain capacity, not full productivity to bring my nieces to the swim meet and the soccer practice and whatever. And so I was content with what I was doing. And then I slowly started poking my head out. And for a project I was doing for a startup accelerator here in Vermont, we started going on LinkedIn and I'm like, oh my gosh, LinkedIn is the greatest thing ever. Like there's so many people, there's so much information, my brain is exploding. It's amazing. And I was usually very analytical. And so I would have been like who to follow and what to do, but somehow the universe connected me with some people. And two of those people were Jared and Galen. And then I also met Jen Ferguson and she invited me. I was member 97 for Rev Genius, which is I think now like 15,000 people. And so I'll speak to the community piece. It's, to me, I didn't know any different, right? So to me, it was bundled in with LinkedIn. It was like, oh, those communities, like people are getting together and they're doing stuff. And sure, you know, there was Revenue Collective I knew about and Modern Sales Pros and all the other groups, but they were like a distant, I don't know, for some reason, they weren't as much on my radar, maybe being on the ground floor and made Rev Genius like, whoo. And so to me, it was heightened by the pandemic. Certainly, we're all working from home. We're all looking for connection. We're all looking for ways to feel part of something bigger than ourselves, beyond our family or beyond our workplace. And especially with the labor market, right? That's when it was still really tricky. Aspect of it was just be as inclusive as possible, come up with guidelines, and it didn't have to be perfect. So it was, you know, really moving so quickly that trying to onboard 500 people a week, like obviously you're not going to win any wars. Like you're making the best onboarding possible, but just quickly coming up with what are some basic things people need to do. And I realized with time that I actually just naturally do this. Like, so when my nieces joined the swim team, I'm like, I don't know what's going on. Where's the information? Where's the meet? How do we get to the meet? What do the families need to know? What do we need to bring in the swim bag? How did the event work? What's the order? And so I offered to volunteer and I'm like, I made a whole manual, like here's the 15 things, you know, 15 different, you know, one sheeter is about swimming. And similarly, that's how it started with Rev Genius. I literally was a member for like 2 days. I'm like, I think we need a frequently asked question. And they're like, sure, why don't you do it? I'm like, okay. And you're it. Yeah.
Right.
And then Anish and Christina were the community leaders at the time working with Jared and Galen. And then Christine Whitehead joined the fray and we kind of traded the baton back and forth. And it's funny to me because I've just recently looked at the Rev Genius onboarding information And sure, it's been slightly revised, but the core of it is pretty much what we did, you know, when we were flying by the seat of our pants, just quickly throwing it together so we can have at least some information for people back in June. And so what I feel about that is that it's, again, part of it was ironic because, like, we're all in sales and marketing. It should be like the customer journey. And we didn't quite have all the pieces. And I tried not to get caught up that, oh, we didn't have the pretty diagram, or we didn't have like each, you know, the status segmented right away. And just embrace the idea that initially people just want to feel connected. They want to jump in a couple of channels. Maybe they want to have funny memes. Maybe they want to express gratitude. Maybe they actually have a sales question they want answered and someone can help them. And then there's the separate women in revenue channel. And yeah, so it was a great, great experience. And it just got me right in the mix. And to me, I feel like it's, I never thought about community as a job because, I don't know, again, I must have been living in a cave or something. But it really is like now it's this flourishing thing. Like I can't look on LinkedIn without seeing five different, oh, we're starting a community. There's a job open for a community. And so I think the key piece, it's like any other customer journey. It's like, what is our purpose? What are we doing? Who are we trying to reach? And then how are we reaching them? How are we getting them interested? How are we getting them approved or become members? Some of them are free, some of them are paid, these communities. And then how are we onboarding them? And then how are we continuing to re-engage them? And how are we turning them into evangelists? So it's like the same principle, but just looking at the supportive communities, whether your sector is customer success or ironically communities for communities or revenue or products, marketing or whatever. There's 10,000 communities now. And I think it's all predicated on the same premise that we all use in our sales and marketing lives to create the connection and create value for others while add value to others while we're also, you know, learning ourselves and embracing, enriching our.
Catherine, do you think it's fair to think of communities as really the magic bullet when it comes to growth mm-hmm. for companies, right? Do you think that's how we should be approaching it? Because for a lot of companies, that's literally the one lens they'll put on almost all.
Yeah, I think it's like Clubhouse. Like Clubhouse worked for some people. There was like the tipping point, at least on LinkedIn in January. It was like, oh my gosh, Clubhouse, woo! And some people went all in and they're flourishing and it's working for them because they were really clear about what they wanted out of it. Other people felt like they missed the TikTok B2B and they're like, oh my gosh, I gotta get in front of the curve here. And then other people just tried it like me and I'm like, oh, I did some cool rooms. I did some things. And so, I'm not as active in Clubhouse anymore. And I feel like people tend to gravitate towards the hot new thing. But like any hot new thing, it's like you have to have a strategy and it has to fit with what you're trying to achieve. And just thinking, I'm going to be in Clubhouse or I'm going to build a community and they will come. I mean, it's not Field of Dreams, right? Like you still need to do the work and you still need to be really, it has to align with your strategy and your values. And the most important thing is your resource allocation. You can build a community and invite a lot of people, but if you're not nurturing it and you haven't devoted human and other resources to getting sponsors, so there's, you know, extra events, so there's people overseeing and, you know, cultivating the community, then you just have an empty Slack channel or a couple of Slack channels. So I think like anything else, it's like, what's the ROI on your time and investment? What's the opportunity cost? Like if you hire someone to do community, what else could they be doing for you? If they were doing straight marketing or some other, they're doing field marketing, or if they were doing, you know, like the liaison between sales and marketing, whatever the title may be, is that going to get you more bang for your buck? But I do feel fundamentally that communities are an essential piece of it because everyone wants to feel connected and everyone wants to feel together. And there's a lot of value in how people with similar interests and desires and knowledge can help each other and feel part of something bigger than themselves through a community.
A lot of people think of Red Genius as, you know, a case study for communities and sort of community-led growth as yeah. well, right? And rightly so. What do you think is really the main thing that has kept Red Genius the way it is and active and
It's interesting. I've definitely thought about this a lot. So in the beginning, Rev Genius was almost a case study in hyper growth and was it going to be sustainable? I mean, Jared and Galen are amazing and the other people they've brought on board, you know, I stopped volunteering maybe end of October. So they now have full-time people and the DJ just joined as a full-time person and they just hired Asia, who she's amazing. So there was the tipping point where it was, is this going to be sustainable? Was it just a COVID thing? But they were pretty smart about making it very inclusive, making it get a threshold of numbers. So it wasn't just like 400 people sitting in a Slack channel that wasn't maybe going to, you know, stay sustainable because whatever percent of people participated, like you have to look at all the stats on that. And then getting sponsors. Like I think a key piece was like really making partnerships and allyships and alliances with SalesLoft and with Dooley and with all these other companies that are very active on LinkedIn. So they're doubling their bang, you know, they're making the good the sum of the parts greater than their...
I think it's interesting how you talk about, you know, the sum of all of these things being greater than each of them individually. And I think that's really true for so many of these initiatives, right? Like whether it comes to community, whether it comes to diversity and inclusion efforts, women in sales. I think the fact is that people together can do so much more than they probably could do in isolation. And now is a great time to learn that. I think the other cool part is also that with the entire world kind of, not the entire, but with such a large part of the world going online and digital, it's so much easier for people to connect with each other, right? And that's probably part of the reason why we're able to rally community so much. Great, love that, Catherine. Yeah, I think it's powerful how technology and people can really come together and do a lot of really amazing things, no matter where they may be based. So Catherine, we're kind of towards the end of this. I guess one of the things I'd love to know from you is, you know, what can people really reach out to you for and what's the best way to reach? No, I think that sounds pretty incredible. The idea of, yeah, just the courage to do things differently, even if they don't scale, right? But yeah, I think that's powerful. I feel like, you know, so my personal thought on that, my hypothesis rather, is that a lot of these clashes happen when you're talking, when you're kind of scaling up things, right? If it's a smaller team, if they're just, you know, one person sort of leading on something or a couple of people just with one head, then it's sort of easy to keep everyone rallied and part of the same team. But when you kind of scale up and you have one person in charge of one separate thing, then I think there are many more chances of people stepping on each other. So that's possibly what happens here as well to sales and marketing. It's sad though. The funniest thing is, Catherine, you know, I've read that article a couple of times as well. And whenever I'm speaking to Shruti now, maybe about a new idea, I'm like, is this a Lego I want to hold on to, or is this a Lego I want to share and let go of? Great, Catherine. Thanks so much. I think this was a super amazing chat to have. Thank you for being here. Awesome.